But there used to be these drive-in movie theaters. I don't know if you're familiar with that, where you have a big screen outdoors and people pull up in their cars, you know. But many times the purpose of that in the privacy of their car or semi-privacy of the car, people would then be engaged in sexual activity while the movie was on. And in this particular case, the film was also maybe a pornographic film or something close to it at this drive-in theater. But a group of devotees were going car to car distributing books and collecting donations. I don't know who sent them. And they never did it again. But there were men and women in that party. And the interesting thing is, the men came back all agitated. But the women weren't that upset. You know, there's on this film, there was like very gross behavior. The women weren't that agitated, but the men were agitated like crazy. But then later, they would send, men and women's party out in the evening, door to door on book distribution. And there you'd knock on a people's door, and there would be this nice little married couple in the living room, and the children in the fireplace, and all the men and women, they're all living in the temple. There were brahmacharinis, brahmacharis. No one was a householder, or if they were, they were living just like brahmacharinis and brahmacharis. And so when they came back from that, the men were bleh, you know. But the women were really agitated and upset and wanted all to get married and, you know. Because there was the wife, there was the children, there was the living room, you know. That's also sex desire. So that sex desire gets expressed in different ways also. So one should take that into account also that it's just that men and women are wired into material nature in a different way. So in men it may be expressed in rather gross on-off sort of agitation like that. But for a woman it may be a little subtler sometimes, but it also may be quite deep-rooted. Because generally it's true that the idea of transcendence is kind of a male project. You know, because look, I mean, what is the male contribution to procreation? Yeah, 5 minutes at the most. Really, really a quick job. You know, what a man's contribution. What's a woman? What happens to a woman involved with procreation? Well, every month she's going through a cycle. Her body fills up with fluids and this whole thing. And then when she gets pregnant, her body gets taken over by material nature. And, you know, I mean, she just, this baby is growing inside, she's, you know, she's being, no man has an experience like that of quite being controlled by material nature in such a deep way. And then a child comes, what's her bond to the child through nursing and things like that? A man doesn't have experience like that. So a man, you know, it's easy for a man to think, you know, it's possible to get free from material nature. But a woman says, are you kidding? You know, I mean, it's just like that. So that idea maybe first of all occurs to men more than to women. So for that reason that there's a quite different perspective on things in this way. And so the woman's attachment may actually be quite deep, although not so obvious as a man's is. You want to? Okay, good enough. That's my answer.
Part two of the same question reads, so generally women are very much passionate and are less intelligent. Please comment.
That's what the Shastras say. However, I take people as they come. And if a woman is not passionate and not less intelligent, I accept that she's not. I don't say you're a woman, therefore you're passionate, less intelligent. I say it's nice that you're a woman and you're not passionate and you're more intelligent. When a woman becomes a devotee, everything changes. When Prabhupada came to my temple in 1975, he had just been in Chicago. And some woman reporter was really on his case because of these statements about women being less intelligent and so on. And you know, Prabhupada, when somebody challenges Prabhupada, he just fights back really, really hard. And the second thing he does is he liked to provoke reporters. He really did. He liked to provoke them. It's not like our contemporary public relations people do, but he liked to really egg them on a little bit. And so this woman was challenging Prabhupada on this matter, and Prabhupada just dug in his heels, you know. And then he came up with this thing, which he learned in his physiology class or anatomy class, whatever it was. It's not in the Shastra. It's from some textbook from Scottish Church's College about the size of a woman's brain as compared to a man. I don't know what the ounces were, you know, 32 ounces or opposed to 64 ounces. You know, they measure cranial capacity. You know what they do? You take a skull and you pour rice into it, and then you measure the volume of the rice. So they do that to men's skulls and women's skulls, and there's less rice in a woman's skull. Now, nowadays, it's thought that it doesn't say anything about your intelligence, but anyway, that was what Prabhupada was taught in college, was that women was less intelligent. So he, you know, carried this, said something about 32 ounces, and it was in all the newspapers and everything like that. So when he came to Philadelphia. So there was also a reporter, a woman from a local newspaper, who's doing a big spread in the Sunday section on us, you know, and she heard about this stuff. So she was quite challenging to Srila Prabhupada, you know. And so Prabhupada really got on her case too. And so after the whole thing was over, and people had left after a darshan, and he was dealing with this reporter, a couple of ISKCON women were like a little upset, because, you know, he's heavy. And and he said, Vishaka and who else?
Ananda Manjari, especially this.
I think the tape recorder had been turned off, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But they said to Prabhupada, is it true that we women in ISKCON are less intelligent than the men? And Prabhupada's eyes got big. And he says, no, he says, when you become a devotee, your brain grows. So I heard it with my own ears. So I just take people as they come, and if the woman is less passionate and more intelligent, then, you know, the man should follow the woman, not be puffed up.
What is the best recommended age to enter into Grihastha ashram, and how many children are Grihasthas allowed to have in this day and age?
Recommended age, Prabhupada generally says 25 for a man, and maybe, you know, 20, 18, 19 for a woman, or something like that. This is something that's culturally adaptable. He says past 30 a man is spoiled for marriage, by the way. 30 is sort of a cutoff point. After that, it's very difficult. So a man at least sometime between 25 and 30 is best. Again, how many children you can have? Well, first of all, you have to be able to support them. I said that's usually very difficult in this day and age. And also, you have to be able to make them Krishna conscious. So, if Bhakti Siddhanta said, you know, if he could, if all his children could be great devotees, Bhakti Siddhanta said he wouldn't, you know, he could have tens and tens and tens of children. So that there's no number, but except that has to be there, how many you can support and maintain nicely. I mean, and that also you can make them Krishna conscious.
I just wanted to mention about that Prabhupada said that the marriages, he suggested the marriages be arranged by the god brothers and god sisters, and of course now we have many gurus, but the idea was people who knew the devotees well, because it's very important to try to have them evenly matched, like Prabhu was saying, how it's very good that people have the same idea about how they're living. You know, one person may want to live simply as a in the temple doing deity worship and austerely, and someone else has an idea of, you know, a four-bedroom house with a Volvo and the garage. So, you know, it should be discussed before. And the degree of commitment to, even in Grihastha Ashram, to have as little sex as necessary, that's the highest standard, and people should be agreement on that. So it's good that those things are discussed before. And as far as the ages, we made the mistake in America reading about in Vedic civilization how, you know, young girls were married at a very young age, and we had a whole series of Gurukula girls who grew up the first generation in our movement who were married very, very young. And later it was seen that at least because of their some Western upbringing, and that it was actually a mistake. Most of the time it didn't work out very well, you know. And most of the girls, you know, they want to continue with their schooling and you know, be a little older. So really requires that it's so good if it's carefully done ahead of time, you know, with people who actually care about them and know them well, and to help in that decision.
What happens when a couple who are married for some time and cannot have children? Should they seek medical help to have children?
An interesting question. I never really thought about it before. I know people that have, actually. I suppose that can be done. It may be some very simple thing that's required to correct that. Sometimes some of the medical procedures that infertile people do for having children are so artificial insemination and all that other kind of stuff. You start to wonder what's really going on. You know, they take semen from a man, ovum from a woman, put them together in a petri dish. Now, what's the consciousness of that child? I mean, who knows what's going on, you know? When this stuff is done in the laboratory and then implanted in the womb, I think that's going too far as a general rule. It's better at that point you adopt a child or something like that and raise them to be Krishna conscious. That would be my general tendency. I can't say in every case on this kind of thing. But I think initially there's no problem with the seeking medical advice. But, you know, for so many medical procedures, at a certain point, the devotee may think, you know, this is an over-endeavor also.
This follows. Kindly give me your opinion on the fertility drug. Can one go on this drug if one marries at a very late age? Because there's a chance for one getting twins, triplets, quadruplets.
Can you raise them? You know, there's a natural rhythm for things. And Prabhupada makes a very big point that, you know, Ajamil was a very old man with a very young child. And this is, so the best time is to to have children is when you're young. And these things where you start to interfere so much with the natural course of material nature, we should not trust so much. People don't know what they're doing. So, you know, you read a story about a 65-year-old woman getting pregnant and having children. I mean, and then who's going to raise the child? I mean, there's so many other things like that. You know, one should preferably try to fix one's life so that by the time you reach 50, your children are pretty much grown up. And that's what one should do. And if, you know, you're married and you're not blessed with children, well, you just, some things you just have to accept as Krishna's will. You can take a few steps to see if there's anything to be done, but if it becomes an over-endeavor, then you just have to, you can adopt some child. I'm sure there's plenty of children around. I know devotees in America have adopted a child, and even there's an available pool even from ISKCON circles, unfortunately, but that can be done.
At this stage, if you have further questions, if you have written them down, you can send them on this aisle and that aisle to Pavitram. Next question. Dear Maharaj, Hare Krishna, thank you for coming to South Africa. Here are some intimate queries generally raised by grihasthas. Kindly clarify for the benefit of all of us so that no confusion exists. Please do not laugh. This series of questions appeared quite a few times. Are the husband and wife allowed to sleep on the same bed daily? If, now there are five different situations, I'll take two at a time. If they have no kids and if their children are younger than 5 years old.
Well, I mentioned this before. I think as a general rule that if one wants to avoid unnecessary sexual agitation, it is a good idea whether there are no kids or there are kids under five, sleep together in the same bed. The general Vedic standard, I mentioned this before, is best is a husband and wife can have separate bedrooms, or if not, they have separate beds. I don't think it matters what age the children are. Okay.
What if they are in Vanaprastha ashram and if they're traveling and one bedroom is offered to them?
If one bedroom is offered to them and there's only one bed, then, you know, that what can you do unless one wants to sleep on the floor? But if it's a temporary situation or something like that, then okay, that may you have to do. Say something.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have this one friend, Deviani, when she was first married to her husband. Prabhupada actually told them they need a bed. So I don't know the whole detail of it. She told me that. And so I mean, in a sense, it contradicts, but not really, because the idea is you don't want to cause unnecessary agitation to the person. So it's something that the individuals really all have to see. You know, you're doing harm to the other person if you're causing your husband agitation unnecessarily. And also vice versa. So I know couples who are very strict, and I know very fact, and yet they have one bedroom and they stay together. You know, for some reason or other, they're able to work that out nicely. So I wouldn't want you to think it was just a rule. You have to get the principle underneath of it. You know.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
The general principle is not to cause unnecessary agitation. But people
have different ways on how you know, that's part of getting to know one another and to know how, you know, you're trying to help each other fight against lust. So I really think that's so individual that you wouldn't want to make a hard and fast rule or make unnecessary assumptions. But
the general, anyway, there's nothing wrong with beds. That's okay. Householders can have beds. But I think for most of us, two beds are safer than one.
Next question. Hare Krishna Maharaj. Must a grihastha produce children? Or put it this way, is it a must for grihasthas to have children? Or can they assist in Srila Prabhupada's movement, example, by going to pilgrimage instead of spending money on the children, causing more attachment? Can they not give that money to their preaching mission?
When somebody wrote Prabhupada, he said, we're married but we don't want to have any children. And Prabhupada wrote back, if you don't want to have any children, why did you get married? I think to Prabhupada this was a kind of astonishing idea. that people would be married and not have children. Now again, it's not a hard and fast rule. And there are people in our movement, the husband and wife are cooperating together and serving Krishna and so on like that, and not having any children. Especially both of them want to be fully dedicated. They don't want any distraction. But it's a little unusual, I think. And it's only something that somebody would think of in the 20th century to be married and not to have children. I think at one point in our movement, children were discouraged in a way, because you get the husband and wife, you want to keep them both on Sankirtan, and you were discouraging them from having children. And I think part of the function of the Gurukula, they wanted to keep the parents out of the way so the parents could stay fully engaged. And that was not right. That was really not right. So as a general rule, again, this is a general rule, that if you want to be that renounced and dedicated, you know, why get married at all?
The Shaka told me she was there when Prabhupada was quite insistent that the purpose of the Grihastha Ashram is to raise Krishna conscious children. So it's actually the purpose of it. And she asked him, because at that time she and Yadabhar didn't have children. She was traveling with Prabhupada to take, you know, photographs. So she was kind of pushing, well, do we really have to have children? She didn't want to do that. And Prabhupada kind of, well, you and your husband, you're making your photography, you're the center, you know, your service. But actually after Prabhupada left the planet, then she understood the wisdom of it. And I've seen different places in Prabhupada's books where the austerity of the Grihastha Ashram is raising a Krishna conscious child. All of us who have children understand what an austerity it is. So if you take the advantages of an ashram and you don't undergo the austerity of it, then in a sense you won't get the full benefit. It'd be like, you know, someone taking the advantages of a brahmacharya ashram and at the same time not undergoing the austerity of, of not associating with women. So, but on the other hand, I also know sometimes, you know, people want companionship. They're older, they're, you know, in their 40s or whatever, and, you know, they're not going to start a family. So there's exceptions, but generally it's the purpose of it.
If you kind of go straight to the Vanaprastha Ashram, you might as well take a little tiny leap and go on to the sannyas, you know.
We have two situations. First of all, for some practical and financial reasons in homes, the wife and the husband have to work. On the other hand, it is said that in Durban temple, most of the grihasthas perform a lot of preaching activities, which include organizing festivals, cooking for the Sunday feast, and preaching in their namahatas. And therefore, in both situations, their children feel a bit neglected, whether the husband and wife are working for some practical or financial reasons, or whether both of them are doing service. So how to cope with the situation?
One thing I do know, and I think it was either 75 or 76, there was a darshan, and this was about deity worship, but they asked Srila Prabhupada whether the ladies who had, you know, young children,